This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Okay, with apologies to Jay Powell, what if we try it this way? What is OPEC Plus thinking in five words or less? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Wednesday today, the third day of August. Good as always to have you along, everybody. As we have reported many, many, many times on this program, there are but two ways to bring oil prices down from the $100 or so a barrel they have been dancing around since the beginning of March: reduce demand or increase supply. The Biden administration has been leaning hard into the latter, encouraging energy companies here to actually start drilling. We talked about the thousands of permits those companies have yesterday. The White House has also been encouraging countries in the OPEC Plus cartel to increase their output. See also the president's recent trip to Saudi Arabia. Well, today the cartel did agree to pump a bit more, 100,000 barrels a day come September. Sounds big, I know, but this is oil we're talking about, the global economic lubricant. And in that context, 100,000? It's kind of tiny. In July and August, just for instance, the increase was 600,000 barrels a day. So we asked Marketplace Justin Ho to look into the question of this day: what is OPEC Plus thinking? But we're going to give him more than five words.
OPEC uses announcements like these to send a signal to oil markets. Matt Smith is lead oil analyst with the data and analytics firm Kepler.
Because OPEC controls so much of the global market, they have the ability to move prices just on what they say.
And by pledging to boost output by just 100,000 barrels a day, OPEC could be sending a signal that it thinks a recession is likely and demand for oil will fall.
As we've seen previously with recessions, people lose their jobs, they have less money to spend, and people cut back, and you see that reflected through in energy demand.
There are signs that demand for oil is already weakening. Oil prices have fallen over the past month, and gasoline demand this summer has been pretty muted, says Amy Myers Jaffe, a professor at Tufts University.
Summer gasoline demand in the United States is not as healthy as it was expected to be, and we are seeing the price impact.
President Biden has been trying to persuade Saudi Arabia, the de facto leader of OPEC, to produce more oil so gas prices keep going down. Bob McNally, president of Rapidan Energy Group, says that puts OPEC in a tricky spot by announcing such a small increase for September.
They've delivered on a step that the White House asked for and expected, but yet they really haven't changed much.
Meanwhile, other OPEC members, including Libya, Qatar, and Nigeria, have been struggling to meet their existing monthly production targets, says Tom Tsang, director of the School of Energy at the University of Tulsa.
It's hard to say that these different oil exporting countries can all keep their production flowing, can all, you know, systematically increase every first of the month.
In other words, Tsang says 100,000 barrels a day might be all that OPEC can produce. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
We get a regular report from the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. Actually, we get a lot of regular reports from the New York Fed. But the one of today shows the amount of debt that people are carrying on credit cards is growing, and pretty fast, too. In the second quarter of this year, that's April to June, balances were 13% higher than they were a year earlier, the biggest year-on-year increase in 20 years. Even so, though, as Marketplace's Samantha Fields reports, people still have less credit card debt now than they did in the before times.
You could interpret this rise in credit card balances as just something of a return to normal.
People unleashing pent-up demand to travel and eat out.
Ted Rossman at Bankrate says in some ways it's good news for the economy that people are spending so much.
We know that that powers about 70% of economic growth. And then also they're confident in making these purchases.
During the height of the pandemic, Joelle Scally at the New York Fed says a lot of people also use their stimulus checks to pay down credit card balances.
And so we might be seeing some new accumulation of revolving balances on credit cards.
Now that there are no more stimulus checks and other COVID relief, like enhanced unemployment benefits and the expanded child tax credit, has also ended.
The other thing is that the prices of everything are higher now than they were a year ago. So we would also see the balances go up for that reason.
So far, Scally says, even though people are carrying higher balances, most are keeping up with their monthly payments. But there has been a slight increase in the number of people who are more than 30 days behind. And that concerns Chi-Chi Wu at the National Consumer Law Center.
When a credit account goes bad, the first sign you start to see is that you start to see a 30-day delinquency, then a 60-day delinquency, then a 90. And that's when you know that that particular consumer is in a lot of financial distress.
There's another sign, too, that low-income people in particular are starting to struggle more, says Megan Green at the Financial Health Network.
The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau reported last week that low-income renters' credit card debt increased by over 40% over the past year.
And is now well above pre-pandemic levels. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, all sunshine and light, gang, all sunshine and light. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. I saw a piece in the New York Times the other day that brought me up short because, honestly, it was a story I should have been up to speed on, but I wasn't. Anna Swanson wrote it. She covers trade for the Times, also appears here on Fridays as well. And the story was about trade adjustment assistance, a program that's been around for 60 years to help workers who are losing jobs because of globalization. And TAA, it turns out, is going away, just ending. So we got Kara Reynolds on the phone. She's a professor of economics at American University. We want to do kind of a postmortem where she teaches. By the way, at American, she teaches trade. Professor, nice to have you on.
Nice to be here.
Do me a favor, would you, and set the historical scene for me on TAA in the like early 60s, right? Tell me why.
Right. At the time, the United States and countries around the world were engaged in a series of trade negotiations, really, to lower trade barriers. And the Trade Adjustment Assistance Act was really designed to protect those workers who are losing their jobs due to trade because of the increase in imports associated with those decrease in tariffs.
So in the broad sweep of history, then, has it worked?
Well,
tricky question, right?
That is a tricky question. Yeah. So, you know, the goal of the program was really twofold. It was to make sure that workers find new jobs and at a comparable income level. And the evidence is really mixed on the degree to which the program's been successful. There has been some evidence that workers have benefited. My impression is that it's mostly workers who've actually been able to participate in some of those training programs. And unfortunately, in a lot of towns, there's just not a lot of training opportunities available.
The thing about trade adjustment assistance, from my perspective, the guy who's covered this for a long time, and in fact, who literally got this answer from President Obama when I asked him about it, if I could name drop here for just a second, is that politicians of either stripe, when asked about the challenges of free trade, would always say, oh, we've got trade adjustment assistance. Don't worry about anything. We'll get you the training. And it seems mixed success, right?
I will say that even though the stated goal was to find these workers new jobs, the unstated goal was really to get politicians to vote for these new trade agreements, right? Right. So in that sense, it has been successful. We liberalized trade for 30 years. But I think like many of our worker training programs, actually, it's just a very challenging task to try to help workers adjust into new industries.
The thing about it, and honestly, I didn't know that this was happening, and it's my job. I didn't know that it was going away until I read that piece in the New York Times by Anna Swanson. It seems to be being allowed to just wither as opposed to actually be ended, right? And it's just kind of dripping away.
Yeah, honestly, I didn't know it was happening either, and it's also my job. Usually the money for this program or attention to this program comes about when we are forming new free trade agreements. But we've really lost our taste for new free trade agreements, right? The last one would have been the Trans-Pacific Partnership Act, the TPP, that we decided not to even attempt to pass. And so I think that's one of the reasons why no one's really been paying attention to the program.
So do you expect that this is just it and that given our attitudes now about free trade, this program is kind of done and we're not going back?
You know, there is kind of like this anti-globalization viewpoint. I would think that given that viewpoint, there would be more efforts to help workers who have lost their job due to trade, that even though we're not forming new free trade agreements, globalization isn't going away and there's still increasing import competitions. I'd like to think that if not the TAA program, that this is something that we'd pay attention to and think of other ways to help workers adjust.
If I'm a 50, 55-year-old worker who sees their job possibly going away, do you think I'm just out of luck?
I mean, is it pessimistic of me to say yes? I mean, it's just a hard population to serve.
Kara Reynolds, she's a professor of economics at American University. Professor Reynolds, thanks for your time. Ma'am, I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much.
Season 2 of Reservation Dogs premieres today on Hulu. It's a dramedy for teenagers and their misadventures on a reservation in Oklahoma. And it's part of what those who know are calling a renaissance of stories told by and for Indigenous people on TV. It goes along with the sitcom Rutherford Falls and the new police drama Dark Winds. And Native TV critics and watchers want to make sure the trend doesn't stop with just those shows. Marketplace's Savannah Maher reports.
Lately, if I'm cooking or washing the dishes, I'm also re-watching Rutherford Falls, a sitcom about Regan, who moves home to work for her tribe's cultural center.
Hey, Terry, I don't have much time. Regan's in a res fight.
Oh, tell her if she hits the ground, it's over.
Back up!
Monica Brain, who's Assiniboine in Lakota, is also on her second watch.
I got on Facebook and I told everybody that they better get a subscription to Peacock immediately. to show, you know, your support for this.
And demonstrate to TV networks and streaming services that our stories are worth investing and reinvesting in. Rutherford Falls showrunner Sierra Teller Ornelas, who's Navajo, says not too long ago, the show never would have been greenlit.
The sort of assumption was there wasn't enough Native writers, there weren't enough seasoned Native actors.
Or enough people who would watch.
We just really found that not to be true.
There's definitely a market. It's proven now.
Jason Asnap is a Comanche and Muskogee film critic. He says even mainstream audiences are hungry for authentic stories about Native communities, like Reservation Dogs, which pokes fun at stereotypes rather than leaning on them.
We all had a job. We all had a role. That's how we built strong nations, like each a stitch in the great loincloth of the people.
I don't even know what that means, man.
I don't even know what it means, man. I'm just making it up as I go along, all right?
America's been ignoring our stories for, you know, all this time, and now we have so many built up. I'm of the feeling that this will continue.
So those trying to personally boost the viewership data for these shows can probably take it easy. I'm Savannah Maher for Marketplace.
Coming up.
I don't know. I mean, I guess you're supposed to buy things when they're down, right?
Yes, you are. I had to jump on that because it's not a laughing matter. Anyway, first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials gained 416 points today, 1.3%, 32,812 for the blue chips. The NASDAQ jumped 319 points, almost 2.6%, 12,668. The S&P 500 grew 63 points, 1.5% there, finished at 41.55. CVS released strong earnings and raised its predictions for coronavirus-related revenue in the coming year, also saying it expected sales of over-the-counter COVID tests to double this year. Pharmacy chain predicted, furthermore, that demand for annual COVID vaccinations would rise. Makes sense. CVS gained 6.3% today. Some competition in that field. Walgreens rose 0.3%. Rite Aid went the other way, down 0.3%. Bond prices were up. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note thus fell 2.71%. Once again, financial conditions easing. Repeat after me. You're listening to Marketplace.
Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/marketplace, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/marketplace now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/marketplace.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Germany is set to shut down the three nuclear power plants it's still got online by the end of this year. That's part of Berlin's planned transition to green power, and let's save the debate over whether nuclear belongs in that category for another day. Because I mention it now, because this week German Chancellor Olaf Scholz said he might push that shutdown date back just a little bit, given the energy crisis that Europe is having now that Russian supplies of natural gas are suspect at best. Conventional wisdom in the West, as you know, is that Russia's tightening up on gas supplies to Europe, and to Germany in particular, to A, do damage to the German economy, Europe's biggest, and B, sow a little discord among the European allies. Is it working, do you think? From the European desk, Marketplace's Stephen Beard has that story.
As Germany scrambles to conserve its natural gas, many Germans now regret succumbing to the fatal allure of Russian supplies.
They offered very cheap gas prices, and that was very attractive. And this is why we are now in this mess.
German energy expert Claudia Kempfert, who for years, along with the US and some other countries, warned of the dangers of depending on Kremlin-controlled energy.
Germany did not listen. They did their own decisions, and that was wrong.
She's not the only one beating up her country for getting hooked on Russian gas. Mike Taylor of Oxford Analytica says there's real annoyance with Germany among other EU member states.
A lot of annoyance, particularly in Poland. There's a lot of friction between Warsaw and Berlin.
The Poles have long objected to Germany connecting itself umbilically to Russian energy sources.
Yes, they've been saying, what on earth possessed you to commit so much of your gas supply to the Nord Stream pipeline?
The Russians have now cut the flow of their gas through Nord Stream 1 down to 20% of capacity. Speaking to the BBC, Polish Foreign Minister Paweł Jabłonski couldn't resist the temptation to say to Germany, "We told you so."
Some countries have been warning of the situation and have been much better prepared.
Poland has built a pipeline which will start bringing in gas from Norway before the winter. Poland's gas storage facilities are almost full, and Poland's LNG or liquefied natural gas terminal has brought in plentiful supplies from the US and Qatar, something Germany can't do.
Germany neglected the need to build LNG terminals.
Now Germany is rushing to do so and to fill its gas storage tanks, currently less than 70% full. To ease the pressure, Germany eagerly endorsed the agreed plan for EU member states to voluntarily cut their gas consumption by 15%. Claudia Kempfert again.
We need a European solidarity at this time, not only by reducing the gas demand, but also to share the gas which is available over winter time in solidarity.
But reserves of solidarity may be running low. Whether all the member states will be happy to share their gas at the height of winter isn't clear. Paweł Jabłonski says Poland would always be ready to help, but...
We can only regret that the spirit of solidarity wasn't there when decisions of Nord Stream and Nord Stream 2 were being made and then implemented.
There wasn't much solidarity during the debt crisis a decade ago either. Germany lectured its heavily indebted southern European partners, accusing them of gross irresponsibility. Now Germany stands accused of something similar, says Claudia Kempfert.
Now we cannot lecture anybody because we need to get lectured.
And she says it's not entirely clear whether every EU member state would rally to Germany's aid if it ran out of gas.
There are some countries in saying, well, we don't have a solidarity with Germany anymore because they did not treat us well during other crises.
But Germany does have an important factor in its favour. If Putin turns off the tap, Europe's biggest economy will plunge into recession, affecting the rest of the bloc. And that, rather than any genuine sense of solidarity, may unite the EU over energy this winter. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
One of the many rules that companies that are listed on American stock exchanges, that is, companies that are publicly traded, have to follow, is that they have to let regulators have a look at their books. American companies have to do this, as do foreign companies. All of them. So the Chinese firms that haven't are about to be in a bit of a bind. A newish law called the Holding Foreign Companies Accountable Act says companies can't trade on American exchanges if they don't comply with American audit rules 3 years in a row. Somewhere north of 200 Chinese companies have until 2024 to comply, the terms of which are under some negotiation. Marketplace's Jennifer Pack explains what's going on.
I'm going to take you back a few years when coffee was mostly a luxury product in China. Starbucks stores here were pricey and prestigious. And you've got this Chinese upstart called Luckin with cheaper coffee, and it has an app that allows customers to order. As one local TV reporter demonstrated back in 2018, Luckin will deliver even if it's just one iced latte.
Thank you. Whoa, not bad. 15 minutes.
Back then, Luckin was seen as a high-tech Starbucks killer, which appealed to American investors like Seattle native Owen Sun.
It was, you know, very delivery focused, didn't have huge stores that they had to maintain with high overhead costs. And based on how the Chinese economy, at least in Shanghai, was, you know, WeChat, cheap delivery, it seemed like that was the direction that everything was going in.
He was among the first to buy shares in Luckin when it listed on the NASDAQ in 2019. He lost almost all of that investment a year later. Luckin admitted to faking more than $300 million in sales. U.S. regulators have tools to keep an eye on listed companies, says Paul Gillis, an accounting professor at Peking University in Beijing.
The U.S. had passed a law called Sarbanes-Oxley in the early 2000s after the collapse of a number of big U.S. companies, including Enron.
He says the law created the Public Company Accounting Oversight Board, or the PCAOB, to set audit rules and inspect not the listed companies themselves, but their auditors.
Now, auditors, when they do an audit, prepare a set of working papers that document what work they have done to reach the conclusion that the financial statements are correct.
And the U.S. wants full access to these working papers, while China says this could threaten its national security. Lawyer Li Shouchuang helps Chinese companies list in the U.S. with the law firm Dentons in Beijing.
China's government has proposed to approve the working papers first. If state secrets are involved, China wants the right to refuse to provide the information. But the American PCAOB does not accept this.
Because China's definition of state secrets can be pretty broad. Negotiations between the U.S. and China have been on and off for the past 20 years, and this time there's a lot more going on.
On top of tense U.S.-China relations, many American congressmen are hostile or prejudiced against China. What was supposed to be a technical problem has now turned into a political problem.
If the two sides do strike a deal, he says, it still might not be enough to prevent another Luckin fraud. And no deal means 200 Chinese companies must delist in the U.S. They could go to Hong Kong Stock Exchange, a few have, but there's less liquidity, which means if you're an American investor and you want to sell the Chinese stock, you might find it hard to get good prices. And as for Chinese companies,
they want to get listed in the U.S. For many Chinese companies, the U.S. is still their first choice.
Including Luckin, the coffee chain says it's cleaned house. Some reports say it wants to relist in the U.S. Former Luckin investor Owen Sun says he'd have to think hard about buying shares again.
I don't know. I mean, I guess you're supposed to buy things when they're down, right?
In China, he says, things can turn around quickly, sometimes for the good. He just doesn't want to get burned again. In Shanghai, I'm Jennifer Pak for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, about which two things. First of all, yes, I know I'm being played by this stupid publicity stunt, but number two, I can't not because this is the hill I will die on. It has been five long and glorious years since supermarket shelves in this country have been sullied by pumpkin spice Oreo cookies. But sanity comes to an end on August 15th when they come back for a limited run. Two golden Oreo cookies, the company says, with a, quote, festive pumpkin spice flavored cream in the middle. I cannot even with y'all on this anymore. All right, off we go. But here's your moment of economic context. I want to circle back to Justin's story, that 100,000 barrel a day bump from OPEC Plus that the global oil market is going to get in September. Any guesses as to the size of the global market for oil every day? This is from the U.S. Department of Energy. Daily global petroleum production this year, 100.33 million barrels. 100.33. Daily global petroleum use, 99.58 million barrels. 100,000 is kind of a drop in the barrel, pun intended. And there ain't a whole lot of margin anyway, right? Our media production team is Brian Allison, Jake Cherry, Drew Jostad, Gary O'Keefe, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, Juan Carlos Torrado, and Becca Weinman. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.